Good afternoon. My name's Tom Khalil. I'm the chair of the Global Health Working Group for the Clinton Global Initiative, and we have a great program for you this year. We're starting off with a bang. We have 65 current and former heads of state. We have both presidential candidates will be participating in CGI this year. We have over 1,000 accredited members of the media here. We have a fantastic program that's going to address everything from adolescent girls, maternal and child undernutrition, health workforce, and water and sanitation. We'll also be having a joint session with the Health and Education Working Group. And in response to feedback from our members, we've also identified a number of new elements for the program. We have the CGI Exchange yesterday, which a number of you participated in. We have CGI Connect, which is our own social networking service that's designed to help you connect with other CGI members. And we are also having more of an emphasis now that we're entering into year four of CGI, not only to announce new commitments, but to also give you a progress report on commitments that have been made in prior years. Thursday morning, in response to feedback from you, our members, we're also going to be having a series of breakfasts around particular topics that you can participate in. And that will be a little early, 7:45, but I guarantee if you get up, it'll be worth it because of the opportunity to talk to your fellow members about these important issues. So I'm really hoping that that four things happen. First of all, that everyone who is here and is committed to reducing the large inequities that exist in health between developed and developing countries and within developing countries, first of all, that you find this to be a rewarding and engaging and compelling experience. Second, that you learn something new about the challenges and opportunities in the specific health issues that we're going to be addressing. That you find new partners for your work because these problems are big enough and large enough and complicated enough that they're not going to be solved by any one individual or organization. It really is going to require multi-sector collaborations. And that that finally you're inspired to continue your work, to expand the commitments that you've made or leave the meeting committed to expanding your work in the area of global health. So to start our program, it's now my pleasure to introduce Susan Arnold, who is the president of Global Business Units for Procter & Gamble. P&G is the sponsor of the Global Health Track for the Clinton Global Initiative, and P&G has really been a model company in terms of their participation, making commitments in the area of safe drinking water, in neonatal tetanus, and also in working with six African countries to help adolescent girls stay in school. So please join me in welcoming Susan Arnold.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks, ladies and gentlemen. Procter & Gamble is really excited to be celebrating its third year with the Clinton Global Initiative. So we started with one commitment in 2006. We made two in 2007, and we're proud to announce three in 2008. Our first commitment, children's safe drinking water, is over-delivering on all fronts. We've taken a technology developed with the Centers for Disease Control, what we call a pure packet, and you see my colleagues and I running around with these all week, and we've delivered clean drinking water to those in need. We're currently providing safe drinking water to more than 800,000 children in Africa and Asia, well ahead of our goal. We then increased the original commitment and pledged to deliver more than 2 billion liters of clean drinking water. We're on track to exceed this goal as well, and I'm proud to announce that we're increasing our commitment yet again by another billion liters. We're also committed to deliver more than 300 million consumer impressions with a focused awareness campaign. Public awareness and increased support from P&G will help us build additional plant capacity to provide a billion more liters every year, if that's what's needed. Our second commitment, which President Clinton helped introduce last year, was to deliver 40 million vaccines to help prevent maternal and neonatal tetanus. In just the few minutes I'm speaking to you, another child has died from neonatal tetanus. We want to stop these unnecessary tragedies, and we've established a unique partnership between Pampers and UNICEF. Actress Salma Hayek heard President Clinton's announcement and enrolled to help. Salma helped us raise awareness in no small part by highlighting her partnership on Oprah. That 40 million vaccine goal turned into 70 million vaccines provided. And we've been really encouraged by the difference we're able to make in children's life. And so Pampers and UNICEF have committed to a three-year partnership. We'll deliver a billion consumer impressions and provide 200 million vaccines on our way to help UNICEF eliminate maternal and neonatal tetanus in the 47 countries where it still remains. Finally, I'm delighted to announce a third commitment for our third year, one that leverages P&G's products to help a cause that's really not well known or not well understood. Many girls in Africa miss school because they lack adequate means to manage their puberty issues. This undermines girls' self-esteem and leads many to underperform academically. Some drop out of school altogether. So with the help of our partners, we're making a new four-year commitment through our Always and Tampax brands. We'll reach 1 million African girls with puberty education and sanitary pads to help them stay in school and to feel better about themselves. We'll also install 500 sanitary facilities and reach more than 180 million people in North America with an awareness campaign about this little-recognized issue. In closing, I want to thank President Clinton and CGI for inspiring us to take action. And, of course, we thank our dozens of partners, many of who are in this room today, who helped turn our goals and resources into on-the-ground action. The Clinton Global Initiative and our partners are an inspiration to us all. Together, through these public and private partnerships, we can make a significant impact on global health issues. I thank you all.
And now we're going to see two short videos that document the work that P&G and their partners have been doing. One shows you the work that P&G did in response to the tsunami in Sri Lanka and in response to some similar problems that we're going to be talking about in Haiti. They've delivered over 3 million liters of safe drinking water. And next, a short film on the unique collaboration that Susan just mentioned to eliminate maternal and neonatal tetanus, which is the first time that a company has really gotten behind a goal like that. So roll the tape.
In the wake of the catastrophic tsunami that struck Southeast Asia in 2006, many barely had time to mourn the death of loved ones when they were forced to deal with another devastating problem. In places like Sri Lanka, the rushing waves dump raw sewage into open wells where people get their drinking water, creating a very dangerous situation where people struggled to get the clean water they desperately needed. In conjunction with partners like the Red Cross, the Children's Safe Drinking Water Program acted quickly and immediately, sending 6 million Pure Packets to Sri Lanka. This enabled many in Southeast Asia to focus their attention not on finding clean water, but on rebuilding their lives.
In 57 countries, over 140,000 babies and 30,000 mothers die each year from maternal and neonatal tetanus.
Pampers came to UNICEF to ask, what can we do? Help us figure out what we can do. We knew that over time that we could wipe out tetanus.
Working with Pampers, we began to focus on a very simple idea. For each pack of Pampers purchased, a donation would be made to UNICEF to fund one tetanus vaccine. To inspire moms everywhere to help out, we created a holistic advertising campaign that ran in 16 countries across Europe. And UNICEF celebrity spokespeople got the word out.
This is setting a new benchmark for cause marketing for any corporation. They'll want to do programs that aren't just feel-good programs, but that are saving lives.
Thank you. I'd now like to invite to the stage the three leaders in global public health who are going to talk about commitments that they've made in prior years. And I would like to invite to the stage Nancy Ossie, President and CEO of International Medical Corps, and Gary Haddam, President of Deutsche Bank America's Foundation, and Paul Farmer, co-founder, Partners in Health. So, Paul, I'm going to start with you. And before we get to the commitment that you made last year, you have been working in Haiti for a long time, and Haiti is a country that obviously faces a tremendous amount of challenges and just got hit with four hurricanes. So I'd like you to describe both what you're seeing in Haiti and what are some specific actions that companies, philanthropists, and foundations can take, not only to respond to the immediate challenges, the disaster relief, but also, as President Clinton has said, how do we build it back better?
Thank you very much, Tom, and thank you all for being here. Global health has gotten trendy, and that's good. We like that. I just want to say a word or two about Haiti. The numbers are eloquent in and of themselves. Probably in a month, 1,000 people were killed, maybe more. It's hard to know because there's no adequate reporting, and I'll return to that if we get a chance. And maybe 1 million people left homeless. So this is a 10 to 12% of the population is just without any place dry or safe to sleep. One of the most troubling things, and President Clinton mentioned earlier this morning the reason, that's because the ecological devastation. So this is a bundle of problems that rendered Haiti vulnerable and does every year to these storms that include deforestation, widespread poverty, lack of clean water, back to the product Pure that we heard about and the program that we heard about. And if I know that we have limited amount of time, so I would just like to make one broad appeal to people gathered here, and that includes NGO partners and the business community. I have the privilege of sitting next to Secretary Shalala, who's now president of the University of Miami, and so Haiti's neighbor. And we were talking about the many different NGOs working in the world, and Haiti is a classic example, who failed to coordinate their efforts with the public sector. However weak it may be, it is the arbiter of rights to the citizen, and that includes public education, public health, and public water, back to the question of water. And so I would make an appeal. I hope people are interested in Haiti. Think about Haiti. It's certainly my country's oldest neighbor, and it has been sorely afflicted and will be in the future unless broad systemic efforts are made to build it back better, as President Clinton said. You'll be seeing this week a brochure that the Clinton Global Initiative and the Clinton Foundation have put together, which summarizes some of the work being done by NGOs in Haiti. But also important to note is that the president of Haiti is here. I saw him on the big screen, as others here did. And we need to help them continue to build basic institutions necessary for democracy and modernity. And that's going to be a big challenge to those of us in the NGO, including universities and business communities. So I hope people will pull together and that the together will include the benighted public sector, which deserves our support.
So on Friday, we're going to seek to highlight those members of the business community, philanthropists, foundations, NGOs, who are interested in helping Haiti out of what is a very difficult situation. But, Paul, I'd like to return to a commitment that you made last year which was to create some online communities of practice on global health delivery. What is a community of practice, and why did you think that this is an important commitment to make?
Our group has been, for the last 25 years, concerned to bring the fruits of science and modernity to people living in poverty and thereby help break that cycle of poverty and disease. I mean, the good news, as most people, maybe everyone in this room knows, is that when someone asks the question, usually rhetorical, is it possible to break that cycle of poverty and disease, the answer is an unqualified yes, it is. And technology and technological advances are part of that. And someone would have said to me 25 years ago that because we didn't have, you know, that we'd be using the internet, which I invented actually, that we'd be using the internet to communicate across this very difficult terrain in Haiti, I would have said that was preposterous, that there aren't even landlines. And the answer would have been, that's why you'll be using the internet and cell phones. Dennis O'Brien, who's the head of a big Irish company, that owns a lot of cell phones service in Haiti, has been a major contributor, not just as a donor. He was the biggest donor, I'll bet, to the Haiti relief, a personal donor, but also cell phones. And communities of practice really came out of that idea that we could be linked together as practitioners, as implementer. I'm not a policymaker. I am an academic physician, but what I mostly do is implementation, along with thousands of other people working with Partners in Health. And we knew we needed a way to communicate with others. The splintering of NGOs that I just mentioned means that people can't share best practices. I'm not sure that's the right term, but share innovation from place to place, say from one site in Haiti to another, or from one country in Africa to another, or from the United States universities, a place like University of Miami or Harvard, to another. And what we did with our commitment, the funding we received last year through CGI, was to put in place a network that allows practitioners to talk about fairly arcane but very important things, like how do you keep people on therapy for chronic disease like AIDS? How do you keep them on therapy? Well, how do we assess the importance of loss to follow-up? These are not topics that everybody in public health needs to discuss necessary, but a small group of implementers can really share a lot of information very quickly, and that's what we've done. Over 90 countries in 1 year now, maybe over 100, are now using this service, which links Harvard to places like the National AIDS Program in Rwanda. It's all free, it's open source, and I hope we've made good on our promise, and we're very grateful for the support.
Great. Now, this is part of a larger initiative that you and Jim Kim and Michael Porter and the business school are involved in to create a science of global health delivery. What would it mean to have a science of global health delivery?
So even here in New York, they call it the business school, as they do at Harvard and the college. You know, if you look at, and some of that, there are surely people here from the Gates Foundation, if you look at moving forward the broad goals, like you mentioned, that was mentioned about eradicating neonatal tetanus. You know, we know we need to invest not so much for tetanus, but for a lot of the diseases we're talking about, AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, malignancies, as Lance Armstrong mentioned this morning. We need basic discovery that usually is going to come from the lab. We need development. A lot of that is done by the pharmaceutical industry, but we need delivery. And the weakest link in the chain, in my view, as a practitioner, is delivery. Mm-hmm. We'll have robust, we need to keep investing in basic science. A lot of these discoveries will come from the lab, most of them. We need to have better, more innovative ways of developing new deliverables, especially for people living in poverty who don't constitute a natural market. But delivery is our weak point. And so we said, who knows about delivery? Well, some people who know about delivery are people who run industries or make things. And so that's why we ended up talking to Michael Porter. And he steered us right back in the direction in which we believe, which was to focus on value, the value of the services, in addition to trying to build a new discipline of global health delivery. And that, too, is working well.
Okay. Thank you very much. So next I'm going to ask Gary, Deutsche Bank America Foundation made a commitment to create an eye care fund. What were the premises of that initiative, and what progress have you been able to make so far?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. The starting point for Deutsche Bank is a fundamental belief that capital markets need to be open to social entrepreneurs, that there's a great deal of innovation that's talked about throughout CGI, and it's primarily been driven by philanthropy or government, and those roles are essential, but how do we vest the private sector in those solutions in a sustainable and scalable way? We had great partners in this effort, which is the International Association to Prevent Blindness and Ashoka. And the model essentially is there's 37 million people in the world today who are blind. 90% of those people live in the developing world, and 75% of those people can be cured by treatment. There are wonderfully successful models pioneered by Aravind and Prasad in India. And David Green, who's been a hero in this from Ashoka, defines it as compassionate capitalism, that these enterprises have arrived at a cost recovery business model that really allows them to treat more than half of their clients for free at no cost. And essentially it's through a private pay model. In the developing world, certainly people without insurance will reach in their pocket and pay for eye care treatment, unlike prevention or acute care management. So we as bankers were really intrigued by the idea, how do we take those models and really scale them up? There's tremendous demand for cataract surgeries in the developing world, and it's constrained by a continued reliance on donors and charity. But as any business, if they could arrive at debt financing to pay for their facilities, pay for their equipment, pay for the training of their doctors, they could really begin to meet that demand. So the premise of that really was to grow to scale these innovative models, bring private capital to them, and to really tap into this whole growing sector of double bottom line investing. We really do see more and more investors wanting to see financial and social returns, right. And this was a great way to really tap into that instinct.
And what were some of the obstacles that you encountered in trying to provide debt financing to NGOs?
One is just the NGOs themselves, and IAPB has been a wonderful intermediary in Ashoka, but these are institutions that are really, their DNA is built around raising capital through donations and don't necessarily have MIS plans, business management people on staff, or even a full understanding of what their cost structure is. So the ability for the NGOs really to apply for capital, debt financing is a challenge. It's pervasive throughout the NGO community in all sorts of sectors. And then there's been the regulatory hurdle, which we had a number of hospitals in India we wanted to lend to. In India, an NGO cannot receive financing from outside the country. Mm-hmm. We have a hospital in China right now. We're working hard to overcome some regulatory issues there. And also the donors have been very siloed. They look at healthcare, they look at eye care, and they think donation, and that's what they do. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous role for philanthropy to mitigate risk in terms of bringing capital markets to opportunities and to build the capabilities of NGOs. So they really have the breathing room to build out their enterprises so that they can become commercially sustainable.
Great. So based on your experience, what advice would you have for either philanthropists or investors who are seeking to promote social entrepreneurship in the health sector in those areas where there's a workable model for cost recovery?
Absolutely. And Tom, I really want to assert the point that we're not saying all healthcare can be driven by debt financing. It's a very narrow niche. But for that narrow niche, I really do believe that there's a continuum of capital needs from donations to conventionally priced debt capital. And there's lots of room to play in between. And I think all of us need to think outside our usual boundaries. Deutsche and Ashoka put enormous resources into this, and people like Helle Keller that's here today. This has been a loss leader, but it needs to go beyond that. So it's normalized business. And to make it normalized business, we really need to invest in the upfront startup costs today to build that infrastructure. We need enduring institutions at the local level that are well capitalized and are not at the mercy of outside donors.
Great. Deutsche Bank has been a leader in the area of social investment more generally, not just in the area of eye care in developing countries. And with everything that is happening on Wall Street, I think people are probably interested in knowing, you know, what's the track record in this area? Is this a collateralized debt obligations, or is there really a good track record of being able to identify investments that have both high social and financial returns?
Yes. Thanks for the question, Tom. Actually, I've run this group at Deutsche Bank for 18 years now, and it started out as a domestic effort. And we've done $1 billion worth of financing in the past 18 years, and we've written off exactly two deals which total under $100,000. We have delivered enormous, I think. And you're not applauding me. You're really applauding the NGO partners, because the vast majority of those deals have an NGO in the middle of them. They are the risk mitigants. They are the guys that know how to harmonize government money and private money, and they're the ones who have their neck in the noose if things go wrong. So they're really the heroes of all of this. But it is a enterprise that has good basic fundamentals. Poor people repay debt. If they don't, they don't have a second chance. I hope we learn some lessons here in terms of the viability of partnerships with NGOs and the fundamental ability of poor people to repay their obligations.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. So, Nancy, you were bold enough to make a commitment around expanding the health workforce in some of the toughest countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what the goals of that initiative were and the progress that you've been able to make since that commitment was made.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. You know, many people believe that our future really lies in the investment of women around the world, whether it be socially, economically, or politically. And at International Medical Corps, we believe that health is a key part of that change when it is going to happen. So one of the reasons we focused on sub-Saharan Africa, if you look at what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa, right now it represents about 11% of the world's population. It carries about 24% of its disease burden, and yet only 3% of the health workers available in the world are available to people living in sub-Saharan Africa. And so our goal and our commitment for 2007 was to train 600 health workers, we exceeded that, to work in some of what we call the hardest hit areas or fragile or post-conflict states. That includes Chad, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, CAR, Liberia, Southern Sudan, and Mozambique. And for those of you who know and work in these countries, you know how difficult it can be to carry out this kind of work. So we focused on training in these areas, and our particular focus was on maternal health. The UN states that one of every 16 women die in childbirth in sub-Saharan Africa, and we know that we can have an impact on that way if we focus on the delivery system. So just to talk a little bit about some immediate impacts, in the DRC, we were able to train enough healthcare providers in proper management of drugs. A number of our in-kind partners are here from the drug industry. And they were able to provide critical immunizations for 18,000 women, pregnant women and women of childbearing age, which was a more than 50% increase over the last year. And CAR, the training of traditional birth attendants, were able to serve IDPs and refugees from Darfur. Consultations for pregnant women and women of childbearing age rose 245% in just a very short period of time. And in Liberia, a network of 13 clinics, again, is able to serve 200,000 people and care for about 1,000 patients a month. And the reason why I mention this is that the delivery services, in order for them to be available in these hardest hit or post-conflict states, you've got to have the healthcare worker on the ground in order for that to take place.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the biggest challenges that you encountered in trying to deal in some of these fragile and post-conflict states?
So International Medical Corps has been working in such areas for about 24 years. I heard a saying the other day, a wise person learns from other people's mistakes, a fool learns from their own. We've learned from our own mistakes over the last 25 years, so it kind of gives you an indication. But we have become much smarter over the years by running into and then having to kind of overcome some of the obstacles. But many challenges still remain, of course. One of them is that it's very hard to maintain the momentum that a health delivery system needs. You train health workers, you motivate them, you mentor them, you provide resources for them. And then to plug them into something that is sustainable for over the long term is a real challenge. Governments are often focused on short-term services and not on long-term capacity building. And that is when you have governments that are fully functional.
Right.
And that's not always the case in the places that we are working. And finally, this issue of pay. It's a big issue. If a healthcare worker can make more money doing something else, then a healthcare worker is not going to be able to serve, you know, people in their village. It's a big problem, and it's created a situation where it's not necessarily attractive for a trained healthcare worker to continue to be one. A lot of the funding available today doesn't really address that gap, unfortunately. It's addressed toward emergencies, and we're often present, and most of all these emergencies are in more stable countries as well. But those transitional states, I guess, is what we call them, there is not a lot of investment going into building the healthcare delivery system, and that maintaining that momentum is a problem and a challenge.
Now, in terms of additional partnerships that would allow you to build on your work, what would be some of the most important ones that you could think of?
Well, first I would say...
In addition to a large unrestricted gift.
Yeah, right. Thank you for saying that. That's all we need. Actually, yeah, we had this conversation a little bit before. It is a tough one. I mean, we always have to highlight the need for resources. I mean, just think of it this way. Unprecedented levels of resources and money, thankfully, in the last few years have gone into disease eradication and health technologies and, you know, one of the best things that could have happened to our global health community. On the other hand, we need to also invest in the healthcare workforce, because we all know at the end of the day that in order to maximize those huge investments that are happening now, if the healthcare worker isn't in the village in Liberia to deliver the healthcare, then they're not going to be able to reach the people that would have benefited from all those resources. So I would say we need to rebalance or reallocate or somehow find funds and make them available to invest in the health workforce and the delivery systems, as Paul said. But there are other ways, and part of that is around advocacy. A main reason we have so many resources in disease eradication was because of the advocacy work that was done. So perhaps we need to be doing more advocacy around these issues regarding the health workforce. And then finally, in technology, it was mentioned before, we're doing a lot with mobile phones and PDAs in some of the most remote areas of the world. I don't want to say that that's too easy. All I can tell you is how hard it is to download email or use my cell in many of these places. But on the other hand, at the local level, they're great for referring people to local district hospitals, et cetera. The problem is that these technologies you would think are widely available, they're not widely available in many of the places that International Medical Corps is operating. There's a lot of opportunity to impact on the technology side.
Paul, I know that you've worked in both very disease-specific programs dealing with AIDS and TB, but you've also done a lot of work on strengthening primary healthcare systems. And clearly, one of the challenges is that it's easy to get the media and politicians and faith-based organizations to understand that there's a moral imperative to not let people die of AIDS when we have the drugs available to do that. But how do we get that, how do we use the investments that we're making in disease-specific programs to strengthen overall health systems, and how do we get the same sense of the same ethical and moral imperative to make investments in healthcare systems, which is, by its very nature, a much more nebulous and difficult to understand concept.
I think on the issue of suasion, you know, how do we convince people to invest in delivery systems and health personnel is one set of tasks. Mm-hmm. But leaving that aside for 1 second, back to the technical aspects of this, which, you know, it's not rocket science, but, you know, you can say you can wish to focus on measles, let us say, or tetanus, or AIDS, but without a delivery system, without people to actually deliver vaccines, you know, you can't succeed. So you can't, when you said I've worked on disease-specific projects in the past, actually I never have, because we will use the symbolic weight of enthusiasm around a certain illness like AIDS or tuberculosis, I don't care, maternal mortality and surgical disease, two of our major efforts right now. It doesn't matter what vehicle you use. Again, this is back to the suasive component of our task. You need to somehow be contributing to building up either shattered or weakened or never built health systems. And there's a pernicious ideology out there, which I would like to signal for the people here. The NGO players will already know. And this gets right back to Nancy's point. How would it be possible to have a community health worker be called a community health volunteer? Because basically you're saying go into a little village in Chad where, you know, you're recruiting, let's say, a dozen women who have children of their own to be health workers and then asking them to donate their labor while the consultant who suggests as much gets paid $150,000 a year. Trust me. Trust me. That's the way the system was built in the 80s and 90s, and that is the and it's done great damage to our ability to be nimble and to be effective in difficult places such as the garden spots in which Nancy and I choose to work. Now, and I'll give just the numbers that I find scandalous. I was, you know, a big supporter of the, and I say I our group and I personally were big supporters of the AIDS initiatives and the malaria initiatives, and it's certainly... it's one thing, maybe the only one that I can point to as a great success in foreign policy over the last 8 years. But we tried to make sure that more of the money would actually end up supporting rebuilding healthcare systems in just the way Nancy said. That is, supporting community health workers, supporting local staff, and avoiding the very top-heavy consultancy fees that have characterized overseas development and foreign aid for so long. And that's why the president of Liberia or the president of Haiti have to contend with these, you know, 1,000 points of NGO light everywhere, but can't get anyone to get their acts coordinated together, because there is a machine. It's not a malevolent machine in intent, but in effect, it has a very, again, pernicious effect on our ability to do good work building health systems and making sure that value, to go back to Jim Kim and Michael Porter, that we're delivering value at the end of the day. Because if you have, you know, a big vertical program, to use the expression we use in public health, the technical aspect, an AIDS program, a measles program, a TB program, a tetanus program, that in the end is, you know, causes distortions in an already weak system, then you perhaps have done net damage in the end. But here's a rhetorical question that will be of interest, I know, to my colleagues up here, is can we or can we not deliver metrics to assess whether or not we're building up healthcare systems? And the answer is most certainly yes, we can.
Right. Nancy, you got
to sound like a politician.
Just to jump in on something, I agree with everything, of course, that Paul said. And if you think about it through the context of sounding a couple alarm bells, when you look at all the great investments being made in these vertical programs, we don't want to see those investments wasted. I mean, at the end of the day, I do have a fear of that. I mean, if there isn't a person to deliver that knows how to deliver the drug or the health message, or when it comes to clean water, as P&G is focused on, or when it comes to, you know, HIV/AIDS, then how much impact are we really going to get from, you know, the millions and millions of dollars that have been devoted toward that? And my concern is that people who've put a great deal of effort and resources into this are going to be, over time, disappointed if the health delivery systems are not in place for them to realize their own investments.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking our terrific panel. Don't go away, there's more. We're going to show two videos that also demonstrate some of our fantastic member commitments. One which has been made by Family Health International, which demonstrates the work that they've been making on helping children and families struggling with AIDS, AIDS orphans, children living with AIDS. And then we also have a commitment that Merck has made, a video of a commitment that Merck has made in addressing rotavirus in Nicaragua, where they now have an over 80% rate of immunization. And I'm sure you're wondering, Tom, how do I get a video of my commitment shown? And let me in on a little secret, which is that one of the things that we ask people to do is not only make commitments, but let us know how they're doing. And those people that do a better job of getting in touch with us, of letting us know the both the progress that they've been making and the challenges that they've encountered, we're much more likely to feature your work in prior years. So if we could have those two videos, that would be great. Thank you.
In Kenya's Rift Valley, 7-year-old Faith and her mother walk 10 miles, 4 hours each way, to the closest clinic for HIV treatment. An enormous challenge for anyone, but especially for a mother and child both living with HIV. At a nearby hospital, baby Emmanuel enters the world as one of thousands of infants born at risk of contracting HIV from their mothers. Faith and Emmanuel are just two of the faces of the global HIV/AIDS epidemic. Every minute of every day, a child under age 15 is infected with HIV. Of the 2.5 million HIV-infected children in the world today, 80% are not receiving treatment. 4 out of 5 of those untreated will die by age 5. To address this, Family Health International launched a global effort at the Clinton Global Initiative annual meeting in 2007. The Children's Initiative is a commitment to dramatically increase the number of children receiving life-saving antiretroviral treatment, help parents of those children stay alive and healthy, and strengthen the communities where they live in ways that allow those children and families to survive and even thrive. Within the first 6 months of the Children's Initiative, FHI and its partners have tested and reported results for an estimated 135,000 children around the world. More than 30,000 children are now receiving clinical care, and more than 15,000 children are receiving needed treatment. New healthcare facilities have been built and others remodeled to make them more family friendly. Hundreds of staff have been trained and mentored. Rural care is improving through community group coordination. And FHI is working with 17 governments to help revise and improve their national plans to scale up pediatric treatment. With the support of FHI and its partners, Faith is maintaining her strength and healthy enough to live out her childhood free of antiretrovirals. And baby Emmanuel will celebrate his second birthday as a healthy, happy, uninfected boy. But FHI's work has just begun. Hundreds of thousands of children at risk still need to be identified, tested, and treated. They need modern healthcare facilities and equipment, testing kits and medicines, trained healthcare staff, and a network of support services for them, their families, and their communities. Family Health International is already at work with its 2,200 staff of experienced scientists, researchers, health workers, and program managers. Working in partnership with over 2,000 local and community partners, serving in more than 65 countries to stay ahead of the AIDS crisis. But this can't be done alone. Join some of FHI's major supporters, the U.S. government, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the William J. Clinton Foundation, UNICEF, and Procter & Gamble. Together, we can reclaim a generation from being lost to AIDS. improve the lives of families, build stronger communities, and give millions of children like Emmanuel and Faith hope.
Terrific. Al, are you in the audience? Okay. So next, I want to introduce the next video that we're going to be showing, which, as I mentioned, is a commitment that Merck made several years ago to expand access to the rotavirus vaccine. They got the president of Nicaragua on board. They've reached over 80% rates of childhood immunization on the rotavirus. They were willing to donate the rotavirus vaccine. And then last year, Merck also made a commitment worth over $370 million to donate 3 million doses of their HPV vaccine to help prevent cervical cancer in developing countries. So we're going to have a video that will demonstrate the progress that they've been able to make in Nicaragua. Thank you.
Nearly all children in the more developed countries of the world have access to the latest potentially disease-preventing vaccines. However, in countries like Nicaragua, delayed access to vaccines can have serious consequences. In early 2005, an unexpected rise in visits to doctors for diarrhea among children occurred in Nicaragua. Based on the timing of the cases and limited test results, rotavirus was suspected to be the cause.
We saw a lot of children coming to the hospital, and it went way above our capacity of handling such an epidemic.
Rotavirus is a preventable disease, but it knows no geographic boundaries. Rotavirus infections can cause mild, moderate, or severe diarrhea and vomiting. Mortality caused by rotavirus infection is significantly greater in developing countries, due in part to lack of healthcare access. In the United States, rotavirus is responsible for 20 to 60 deaths per year among children under age 5. Recognizing the public health need for rotavirus vaccination, in October 2006, Merck & Co. Inc. and the Nicaraguan Ministry of Health initiated a joint project to demonstrate the benefit of implementing a full nationwide vaccination program. Merck's $75 million commitment would enable all eligible infants in Nicaragua, approximately 350,000, to be vaccinated against rotavirus over a three-year period.
This is a commitment by Merck to introduce...
The plan was announced by former President Bill Clinton on September 22, 2006, at the Clinton Global Initiative annual meeting. The vaccine to be administered was Rotatec, Merck's oral pentavalent, ready-to-use rotavirus vaccine, which had just been introduced in the U.S. earlier in 2006.
Rotatec is different in relation to the way other vaccines were introduced in our health system, because we're getting Rotatec at the same time as developed countries.
Merck and the Ministry of Health are tracking the impact of this vaccination effort. The success of this program will also help other countries accelerate rotavirus vaccine introduction.
My hope for the children of Nicaragua is that this vaccine will decrease the number of cases of rotavirus disease.
It's a great goal for us to have every year less and less children died of preventable diseases.
Thank you. One of the things that is so extraordinary about CGI is not only the fantastic moderators and panelists that we have, but the audience. And we really are interested in getting the thoughts and views of the people in the audience in addition to the panelists. And CGI has been partnering with America Speaks to design an interactive format that taps the collective IQ of the room. And here to tell us about how that process works is Bob Kolodny with America Speaks.
Good afternoon, everyone. Many of you will remember this feature, those of you who have been here before. The program begins with the panel and the moderator in the panels, and they'll be speaking to the topics that you all are interested in. And as that process goes forward, you're invited to submit questions at your table individually to the facilitator, who will be at each of the tables. And those questions will be fed into the panel and the moderators and responded to later in the program. The panel will be up and working for about a half an hour. And at that point, Tom will return up here and will pose a question that you are asked to address at your tables. And the tables will then have 25 minutes or so to engage with each other around these topics. There will be a facilitator at each of the tables. The facilitator's role is twofold. One is to focus the discussion and support you in that, and the other is to enter into the laptops that you'll have at each table the key ideas, the key considerations that you have developed in your conversations. We have learned over the years that one thing that makes for successful and productive table conversations is that you actually have only one conversation at the table. So if you can all help manage that, it's likely to support you well. And another feature that really leads to productive conversations is to make sure that everyone is included in your discussions. After the tables have had their time, the panel and the moderators will return. Their first role will be to respond to the questions that you've individually submitted during their earlier discussion. Tom will then return, and we will have a summary of all of the themes that have emerged across the tables, because that's what the facilitator will be doing. He'll be entering important ideas, and a group called the theme team, who will be sitting at a bank of computers in the back of the room, will be reviewing everything that's coming in from each of the tables, and will be identifying things that are common across the tables that represent a kind of a broad consensus in the room, as well as what we call gems, which are particularly provocative or interesting ideas that have arisen. So Tom will be presenting those back to all of us so you can sort of see what the sum total of the conversations around the room have highlighted. And then the panel will get a chance to respond to those themes and those gems, the provocative and interesting items, before Tom wraps up that part of the session. The last 10 minutes of the session and our closing will be the presentation and honoring of new commitments, and I believe some progress reports on earlier commitments. So that's what the working sessions will look like. And we look forward to seeing you at the first one at 2 o'clock.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank a number of the people that have helped make this progress possible. I am really just the figurehead for the Global Health Working Group. I can't even say the pretty face. And I, in particular, I want to introduce Hillary Chen, my deputy. You've probably gotten lots of 3 a.m. emails from her. And do we have Courtney Katz? Do you want to wave? And Stephanie Weber? Is Stephanie here? Okay. And in particular, I also want to recognize Sophie Ferris, who's the Senior Commitments Manager for Global Health. And if you have not made a commitment yet and are interested in making one during the annual meeting or learning about some of the interesting projects that could use additional support, Sophie will be able to help you out. Literally hot off the press, we have the Haiti call to action that we've been working with Paul Farmer and others to identify some of the projects that NGOs and companies are interested in working on in Haiti that deserve your support. So Sophie has a couple of copies of this, and we'll be making more available later on during the annual meeting. So that concludes the lunch, and I want to thank everyone. We're going to be starting up at 2 o'clock with a terrific panel on the health of adolescent girls, so I encourage you all to come back at 2. Talk to you soon.